Further information and tickets available at cap.ucla.edu and kpfk.org.
You're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles and on the web at kpfk.org.
This is Feminist Magazine, a weekly radical radio show and podcast produced by a diverse coalition of feminists. And every week we bring you a mix of intersectional stories and guests to help you resist and engage. And I'm Lynn Harris-Ballin, your host today, and this is what feminism can sound like. Today, we're talking to the director and editor of the film Cuba, which is about Cuba's queer revolution. And it tells a moving story of the whole LGBTQ movement in Cuba, how activists pressed for marriage equality through the 2022 Cuban Family Code referendum. It was a gradual transformation of the social fabric of their country. And the film is incredibly full of life and celebration and an entire insight into queer life in Cuba. And we're talking to Cuba director Kim Ano and editor Kyung Lee. Welcome both to Feminist Magazine.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Kim, let me start with you. And how did you come to make this film? What sort of took you on the journey to connect to this story?
Well, I was making another project in South Florida in Key West and working with Miami actors. And I wanted to figure out what was happening with the science in Key West. And suddenly we realized that the scientists in Florida were actually working with the scientists in Cuba, but kind of under the radar. So then we thought to ourselves, we got to get there. We just got to go. And this was in 2016. And I decided to pick the time during the Jornada, which is the international LGBT celebration and conference in Cuba. I wanted to find out what was going on with the community, being a lesbian director myself. So we went and we're like, you know, setting out to do one thing. And then we realized, oh my God, there's another story here. And so that's how it started. That was in 2016, so it was a long time ago now.
So quite a journey to make the film.
Yes.
Yeah. And did you have a sense at the beginning of how you were going to tell the story, or did you let the story unfold from all these amazing, I want to call them characters, but they're people who you chose to focus on were really beautifully chosen?
You know, I didn't know what I was doing. I was listening to a lot of voices and wondering what their journey was and just kind of started filming, filming whatever happened and whoever came forward, and then pursued the ones that had deeper stories. But it really is the brilliance of Kyung Lee who crafted the story for this film. So perhaps you might want to say something about how to make a film out of such disparate cameras.
Yeah, I mean, I was amazed at how the story wove and told us, you know, took us on a journey with your key characters. So Kyung, tell us how you did that. What is the secret story source there?
Well, first, initially, Kim had this idea to profile activists in each region in Cuba. And then there's this thing came up, which initially was an election to amend the Cuban constitution. That was, I believe, in 2018. And the activists, so then we thought, oh, maybe we can center the film around this election that was in November in 2018. But then that didn't pass for the LGBTQ plus activists, that they were hoping to pass the marriage equality into this constitution, but that didn't pass. So then we decided to wait for another election, which happened in 2022. That was to change the family code. And so I guess film evolved, and you know, it took a long time to put it together, but you know, it was a team effort to make a film. Mm-hmm. And it's exactly that's the way it happened. Yes.
Yeah. And I mean, the way that you showed us different regions and different ways of life, I mean, first of all, the cinematography is absolutely gorgeous, so that I think is a character in itself. But at the heart, you've got Adela, who's this trailblazing trans politician, but in a tiny fishing town. And then Ramon, who has his theater, but it travels in a little, you know, beaten up bus to villages and brings drag and queer stories to these farming communities. I mean, those two were obviously your key characters, but they were both fascinatingly from a past Cuba, in a sense. They both had come up through the revolution, and how they wound their politics of equality and their activism with the revolution that was so deeply woven for them was fascinating for me. How did you find them, and then how did you choose, Kim, to make them your two sort of key storytelling points?
Well, we knew that they had been the UMAP prison in Santa Clara, and we also heard about the reputation of El Mohunje. And so we kind of pursued El Mohunje, because El Mohunje was an old hotel that was given by the government to Silverio to transform and make a community center. And what he did was, as a gay man, make it the center of diversidad, meaning that anybody who came into the center was going to be honored in some way. And so, like, they structure the 6 to 9 older generation traditional Cuban music dancing. They have classes for children on the weekends. And then at night, from like 9 to 4 a.m., they have a dance party for the young people. And so, and they have like a gallery and a theater and a screening area. They also have 33 people that live there and a cafe. So it's a really quite an interesting location. It kind of reminds somebody of Berlin or something in some ways. There's a utopian sort of feeling around it. But Silverio was very clear that he couldn't just transform Santa Clara, which was really, you know, like, if you can imagine having that UMAP prison being there where a lot of gay people went, and others went to that prison. He took it on the road, like you said, to many tiny little towns up and down the center of the island and the country, and really wanted to bring... I mean, to me, that was like so amazing. Like, can you imagine if somebody got a bus and went to like Mississippi or Kansas in tiny little towns and put up drag shows in the cornfields? I mean, that's exactly what he did. And so I just thought, wow, that's a way to transform. So he really knew his community. He kind of honored the kids of the town. And some of these towns, like Gramate, had like 100 people in it. You know, they were tiny, but he really felt that that was significant to kind of do that. So that's kind of why I thought, you know, we really should, you know, focus on Ramon. And then his good friend, Adela, is the only, well, now there's a number two person, but for years, for a decade, Adela was the only trans person in the state government, in the Cuban government. And she was in prison. Okay, so everybody knows she was in prison, and for being gay, and that was horrible. It was a horrible experience. She talked about that. And then she gets out and she becomes a nurse and then a leader in her area of Cabaret.
And so you focus on these two, but then you also focus on the new generation, which you were given incredibly intimate sort of permission to film them, which was in their homes, in their love lives, with their families. And that was, I think, very, very deeply moving. So, Kyung, how much of that sort of weaving of the story was important to you when you were putting the film together?
Yes, that was definitely important. In terms of me editing the film, I wanted it to emphasize the fact that how each character feels about, you know, them being queer in Cuba, and they were about to change the paradigm of the country by being activists, you know, being, you know, campaigning around this issue. So that's, I wanted it to emphasize. It's not so much about, you know, the big theme about them passing this legislation. It's more about how they feel, what they want, especially what they want as a human being. Mm-hmm. You know, like one couple in the film, they want to have a children, you know, the lesbian couple. You know, that's what they want. So I think that's what I wanted to emphasize, that their wish, their want, their desires.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's like a real quality of yearning and you know, sort of the mothers who love their children, and which I think is very, like, deeply woven into Latinx culture. And there's, like, this, you brought that to us as viewers. So I was fascinated. I don't think I follow a lot of international LGBTQ news, and I had not heard about this referendum, which I'm sure is purposeful, because I'm sure it's comes out of the censorship and the boycott of everything about Cuba. But I was really fascinated by the daughter of Ramon Castro, Mariela Castro, and what her role was. Can you tell us a little bit about that and how you got access to film or interview her?
Mariela is the head of CineSex, which is the Center for Sexual Education and Research. And they actually litigate cases of homophobia and transphobia throughout the country. They have lawyers in different cities, so if somebody has a case. They also make books and publications. They talk about domestic violence and other issues around the family. Mariela had gotten her PhD in that area, and she decided to found the organization as part of the government because she was also a delegate in the party and in the government. How did we get access to her? We have two Cuban teams of production people, one in Havana and one in Santiago de Cuba. And Mirapaca Productions got access to Mariela, and it was a lot of diplomatic kind of negotiations, you know, like, what is this American gonna do, you know, that kind of thing,
right?
And eventually she thought it was a good idea, so that's why she did this. It actually is a two-hour interview that we only put a tiny little bit in, but we have a lot of footage of what she thinks. And one of the things she mentioned was her mother and how her mother had established or tried to establish LGBT issues and the sexual reassignment surgery, like in the 70s, but the population rose against it, so she had to back down herself. So it was really a continuation of her mother's work that started when Mariela was little.
And is Mariela queer herself?
No.
Oh, mm-hmm. Interesting.
She's a heterosexual woman, mm-hmm. a mother of 3 children, and married to an artist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But yet so strongly fighting for these rights.
This is like her main goal, yeah, her main
goal.
Wow,
yeah. Wow. Mm-hmm. And you show through the film that there's like this, the sort of the historic revolution, and you have amazing archival footage of Fidel Castro himself talking about race and, you know, racial equality as an early part of the revolution. But there's not LGBTQ equality, and it's unclear how much women's equality is strongly there. Is this all part of, do you think, I know some of the characters talked about this, some of the interviewees talked about this, that the machismo of the culture, but also the church, right?
Yeah, so the evangelical church is the fastest growing and largest church, I believe, although I'm not sure how many Catholics there are, but there is over 300,000 evangelicals in Cuba today. And they received hundreds of thousands of dollars to defeat this referendum. And so they conducted a very large social media campaign. And of course, they provide food and things, and people are really deprived. So they come to the church to get the stuff. And okay, so now sign this petition against the gay people. So it was a real battle. It was a heavy battle. And both inside government and outside, I mean, and really it's the victory of the progressive forces in Cuba that won this and convinced the population that human rights for our communities was the best thing to do. But there always is this fight against the evangelical church and also machismo, and the kind of the history of machismo and patriarchy within Cuba and all of North America and all of South America. We have a giant M machismo ruling us today. So, you know, this was a period of real reflection about what the damage of machismo did in the country and how it created transphobia and homophobia.
Right. So, Kyung, you also wove in music and kind of short, brief clips of dance and performance and drag in very specific ways that lifted the story. Can you tell us about that and how you chose that?
I think, Kim, you might want to answer this because this is Kim's specific direction. And so, you know, to put performances they used as part of their activism. And so we definitely wanted to include that.
I guess what I would say is that music is always 50%, if not more, of my projects. And the legacy of Cuban music is so is such a high bar. Cuban music is genius music. So I couldn't put any music that wasn't going to work it well. And so we had a composer who's actually Brazilian, but he was influenced by Cuban music. So he worked on that. And then we did license some very important, like Los Zafiros from 1959 and Moza Habana, the song. I think that music really captures the emotional content. And also because they did performances, and that's another problem that me and Kyung had, is they did performances to songs that are like, 65 billion hits. So it was really hard to get licensing for those kind of pop songs. So we really had to do a dance about how to tease it out. And because we're an independent group here, we don't have any big backing. And, you know, it's not like we can negotiate with a ton of people. We did get licensing from Sony Music, and Brittany Duchek is our music supervisor. Thank you, Brittany. She helped navigate us through this morass of how to get music licensing. But yeah, music is important to me, you know, bottom line. You know, I grew up with it, and throughout my life, I always go to music. Like right now in the middle of fascism, I'm listening to a lot of music.
Sure, yeah. We need all of the the queer joy and the upliftment that we can find to keep us going through so many things that are going on right now. Absolutely. And so this multi-part storytelling for both of you, I know that you're both filmmakers and you're both artists in other areas. Have you both used this kind of multi-point of view storytelling before? I know, Kyung, you've also made short films, and is this something that you like to work with?
Well, you know, I make films. I make my own films, and I also edit other people's films, but it's always a challenge to have to edit a film with multi-characters in it, especially Cuba was more challenging for me. I mean, any project is a challenge, but since, you know, the characters in the film, in this film, don't intersect each other that much. So that was a challenge, but it's always interesting to work on, you know, a challenging project. Mm-hmm. And this is a beautiful film, and, you know, Kim is an artist, and this is her first feature-length documentary film, and we are really happy that we can bring this film to Los Angeles this week, Saturday.
Absolutely, yeah.
I want to say one other thing, as Kyung directed a really important film called We Are Here, which actually gave cell phones to homeless people and had them film themselves, and then she edited that together. So we have been thinking about how to elevate the participant into being more like a co-producer in mm-hmm. some ways. And so Kyung really was able to put a brilliant trilogy of portraits of homeless people in East Oakland encampment.
Wow. So that's definitely part of this kind of bringing the participants into the storytelling and then multiple
Absolutely.
Points of view. Yeah. Which mm-hmm. I think was extremely powerful because it personalized this and took it from being, oh, this is kind of a battle for, you know, a group of people. It became these very personal different perspectives.
Can I say one thing about that?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I really appreciate you asking that question because us documentary filmmakers and filmmakers in general, we're under the tyranny of single character driven films. You must make a single character, and there is always the hero and blah, blah, blah of the one person. And that's killing films. I just want to put that out there. We don't go with that. We're not a party to that.
No, and that isn't how we take in life, you know. I feel that it was there were several times when you had groups of people sitting around, whether it was a meal or a meeting, and you showed us many faces or many voices, and I feel that is how the movement happens, and that is how collaborative and community work happens. So it was very true to the story that you were trying to tell.
Thank you.
I'm really appreciative of that. Was there anything that you filmed, or I'm sure there was, what particular was there that you filmed that, like a thread or a story that you couldn't put into the film that you wished you could have?
Fidel apologized for homophobia on part of the state in 2015 in an interview with the La Jornada newspaper in Mexico City. And we really wanted to put that in somehow, but we couldn't find the footage or we were unable to locate how we could really describe it and put it in the film. But it's sort of missing, you know, like... He was reflective, and he apologized. And we asked the activists about that, and they were like, oh, you know, when you do many things, you make some mistakes. And so they gave him a pass in some ways. I mean, some people were still upset about it, but many other people were like, forgave him, and because they still wanted to be part of the revolution. They still felt economically that they would have been impoverished if they didn't have the revolution. And now they're still impoverished in lots of ways because of the embargo. So there's a lot of contradictions rolling around here, but it was really something that I a little bit regret that we couldn't figure out how to do it. Yeah.
There's always going to be that one thing, right? So what would you like people to leave with after seeing this film? You know, now we know that it's going to be showing in LA on Friday, and we'll give those details at the end of
Saturday.
The
Saturday. Saturday. Is gonna,
yeah. But
Saturday 2:45. Go ahead, Kyung. Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. I guess this film is very appropriate right now, especially for viewers in the United States, that we must get united and fight against, you know, the current administration, you know, what they're doing. And I hope people can, like, maybe some get a hint or maybe inspiration from this film, how to get united, you know?
Yeah, I mean, the stakes couldn't be higher in the U.S. to lose for so many bills, 800 plus bills across the U.S. to hurt LGBT people. And the reality of living trans under this period is dire and really hard. So mutual care is needed, like you said, joy is needed, but also real organizing and allying with all kinds of coalition building between communities. And we hope that this story inspires people to actually know you can accomplish something, but you have to do it in a group together.
That's the best message we could have right now, absolutely. So the West Coast premiere, it's happening this weekend, Saturday, September 13th at 2:45 p.m., and it's part of Cine Pride Film Fest at the Landmark Theater, right? And can you give us, is there a link for tickets? Where can folks find information about Cine Pride Film Fest and make sure that they get themselves to the Landmark this Saturday to see Cuba?
Yes, thankfully, due to Kyung, we have the link to the tickets on cubafilm.com, cubafilm.com. There's the link to the tickets. Buy a ticket, $15. Come and see us.
Amazing. Well, we have been talking to two filmmakers about the film Cuba with a Q, that's director Kim Ahno and editor Kyung Lee. And actually, you're both also co-producers. And it's a beautiful and inspiring in a way, but also deeply moving film about this battle to win rights, but also a deep insight into Cuba that I think very few people from, you know, the U.S. have any access to. So definitely folks should go and see this. And I'll repeat again that it's showing on Saturday, September 13th, 2:45 p.m. at the Landmark Theater on Sunset Boulevard in West Hollywood. So go get tickets and go see Cuba. Thank you so much, Kim and Kyung, for joining us today on Feminist Magazine.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you.
Many people make KPFK's programs possible, each giving what they can to help ensure the station's future. One way to help is by donating land or other property that you no longer need. Learn more about the advantages to KPFK and to you of donating real estate at kpfk.org.
La agencia ICE está intensificando las operaciones de deportación en el área de Los Ángeles. Pero si lo detienen agentes de la ICE, usted tiene derechos constitucionales sin importar su estatus migratorio. Si usted o alguien que conoce ha sido detenido o desea denunciar a la ICE, puede obtener más información en Chirla, llamando al 888-624-4752 para obtener ayuda legal y recursos. Es un servicio bilingüe. Para más información, visite chirla.org.
ICE is escalating deportation operations around the Los Angeles area. But if you are stopped by ICE officers, you have constitutional rights, regardless of your immigration status. If you or someone you know has been detained or wants to report ICE, more information is available at CHIRLA at 888-624-4752 for legal help and resources. It is bilingual. More information at chirla.org.
You're listening to Feminist Magazine on KPFK on 90.7 FM and kpfk.org. I'm your host today, Lynn Harris-Ballin.
So I don't have family and I don't have the resources. So when you don't have the resources, you have to go and find them.
We're going to go to Central Ohio, where a single mom's collective hosts a resource pantry.
We're just looking for resources that we can just give to moms with no barriers to entry, with no requirements, you know? And so that's what we're all about.
I'm Amy Gastelum. Stay with us.
Things like that, and now I'm shopping. This is a fridge. This is where we have all our veggies. As you can see, the veggies. I want some blackberries.
It's a sunny Sunday morning. Rugi Ingade sorts through a refrigerator stocked with fresh berries and tomatoes. This is the Motherful Resource Pantry. She's one of a handful of women helping to stock the shelves before it opens at 10. But she's also shopping.
We have a lot of things for evening nights, you know, banana fritters. Look at this, I love mushrooms, I love raviolis, I'm taking this home, you know, even a dessert. Everything comes from Trader Joe's. We've got all of these to take home.
There are a few local companies that donate, but Rugi's right. Most of the food comes from Trader Joe's. They give away stuff they can't sell to local organizations. Motherful serves single moms like Rugi and their families. They know that having enough healthy food is especially important to kids' health and development. Here's one of the founders, Lisa Woodward.
Well, I'm super creative, and that's what I like to do is find ideas and think of ideas. I was a teen mom, but I was super good at finding resources. I see some younger moms that are just having a harder time to like maneuver the path. And that was never really hard for me because of just how good I am at just finding things. And so I like to continue that on, just finding more resources. But that's me. Like, I like to find stuff.
When they first started, Lisa and her daughter Ginger would wake up early before school to pick up the food.
And then we would drive back home and I would get her out and get her dressed for school, take her to school, and then bring the food to the food pantry and put it away. So that's the beginnings of it. And then we finally hired someone to pick up the food every day because it was getting a lot. But we're happy to have it, and it's all high quality, yummy food.
Motherful doesn't check IDs or pay stubs, and they don't ration what people can take.
We have tons of fruits and vegetables. We get a lot of meat and eggs, some surprises. Sometimes Trader Joe's will give us buckets and buckets of flowers, or we get a whole lot of asparagus at once. You never know. You never know. But it's all good stuff. And our moms volunteer and just help it keep going, our pantry.
Besides food, the pantry is packed with diapers and baby formula. There's detergent, shampoo, and even clothing. Black Lives Matter signs hang from the rafters. It's organized enough to find the essentials, but unexpected treasures like romance novels also surface here. Motherful's pantry is sort of like going to an auntie's house and searching through the spare fridge she keeps in the garage. It's almost 10, time to open for business. Some of the helpers take off, but the ones who stay are hoping they're going to see some babies today.
Hey, that baby deserves all the pictures.
Make her pink. That's what I'm telling you.
Love you too. Hey, that baby deserves all the pictures.
The volunteers take a seat around a table, and they stay there until the early afternoon. Hearing them talk and laugh makes it cozy. Meanwhile, a young woman walks in.
What you getting?
Some whack, because there's a shortage, so I'm just going to take a few.
Kay Riley stocks up on formula for her newborn daughter, Wisdom, then asks a volunteer for help finding the right size diapers.
Excuse me, sir. Do you know what size these might be?
Which size are you looking for?
Newborn.
The smallest ones we got, right?
Yes. It's just ones.
Yeah.
You can wear ones too, so that's fine.
Yeah.
On her way out, Kay stops when she sees a pile of books.
Have you gotten books from here before?
I have. I actually read one of them already, which is really good. And they have a book club as well. So.
Are you part of it?
I am not yet, but I tend to be after I get... I just had my baby, so after I get her settled with, I definitely tend to join their book club. They have a lot of good resources here. A lot.
She pockets a novel and heads to her car.
Would it be possible to sit in your car or my car for just a second to talk a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely.
Is that okay?
Well, let me put this in my car.
Okay.
You can walk with me.
Cute purse.
Thank you.
Kay says she started coming to Motherful about 3 months ago, pretty late in her pregnancy. She's from a small town in Northeast Ohio, but she's in Columbus to go to school at Ohio State.
So, this definitely has been extremely helpful for me in my journey as a mother.
How so?
So, I don't have family and I don't have the resources. So, when you don't have the resources, you have to go and find them. And this has been a huge help. Not only, they offer diapers and all that good stuff, but they also offer community. And I think that's the most important thing, especially when you're a single mother by yourself. There's other single mothers that can relate to you. So I think that's the most important thing, that it offers community.
Some of the moms at the pantry today qualify for a government program called the Special Supplemental Nutrition Program for Women, Infants, and Children, also known as WIC. It's kind of like food stamps, but it's only for pregnant people and anyone whose children are under 5. Are you using WIC?
I am. Yes, I am.
And what's that been like?
It's been very helpful, especially with a formula outage. It's still hard to find formula, but, you don't really have to worry about the price. That's been good.
Okay, full disclosure. I've been a public health mother-baby nurse for over 10 years. I've helped lots of people connect with WIC, and my mom used it in the 1980s. But I had never used it myself until pandemic lockdowns. I didn't love it.
I had a baby not too long ago, and I was using WIC. And for me and our family, it was about like $40 a month, basically, was kind of what it equaled out to.
Yeah.
Which isn't huge, I'll be honest.
Yeah, that's true.
It's not, it doesn't cover all of your...
At all. But, it doesn't. I have to agree with you, but a little bit is, I'm still grateful for the little bit that it does provide, but it would be nice if they provide a little bit more, but.
Yeah. And then one of the other things that I found using it too is that it can be kind of complicated because you have to buy certain foods and not every grocery store even.
Yes, I've definitely found that. Not every grocery store even takes WIC, and then you have to scan it, and then just a lot. I've definitely dealt with that. Just trying to find foods that qualify for WIC can be extremely hard and annoying.
I want to jump in here to explain what we're talking about. You can only use WIC to buy certain types of food. The idea here is that by limiting choices, WIC is guiding pregnant and parenting people to healthier food, like whole grain options. Also, participants have to make monthly visits to a nutritionist. That can be hard for busy parents. WIC sees itself as more of a health intervention than a food security program. And to be fair, studies have shown that WIC participants have less premature birth and low birth weight. But they have a big problem. Less than half the people who are eligible for WIC actually use it, about 43%. That's compared to 84% of eligible food stamps users, a program with much less restrictions and rules. It's difficult to know exactly why participation is so low, but as a user, I can tell you that besides the food restrictions and the mandatory visits, there's also a shaming factor.
And there were times when I would get to the register and the person ringing me up didn't really know how to ring up WIC.
Yeah.
And then it's like all your business is everybody's business.
Yes. It can be, yeah, it can be uncomfortable. That's happened to me, like, and they're screaming, well, I don't know how to use WIC. And they're just screaming out to the whole world, why don't you just tell the whole world about my business? Why don't you? I think they definitely should train the individuals a little bit more on WIC. Definitely confidentiality as well. Not everyone wants people to know that they're on WIC. That's just the honest truth. And they should be able to know how to use
it. Because there's stigma. Yeah. Like, you don't know if the guy behind you in line is going to be like,
yeah.
You're welcome.
Yeah, exactly.
For my tax dollars.
Yeah. And that's actually happened before with me.
So one time, Kay was shopping with her sister. They were at the register when the man in line behind them started to laugh.
And he was like, I'm glad my government told, he said something about government, pays your food. And we just kept on walking. It was very uncomfortable for me. And I'm not used to that. So, yeah, definitely confidentiality. Not everybody wants the people to know that they're on WIC, but it's nothing to be ashamed of. Honest, I had to learn that. I had to humble myself and learn. It's not a bad thing. It just has a negative connotation to it. Which is unfortunate because a lot of women do need WIC.
How did you convince yourself that it wasn't anything to be ashamed of? Where did that come from?
I guess it just came in from internalizing me and my own insecurities of using governmental assistance. Like, it's not, a lot of women use it, and it's okay to use it. Especially if you don't have the resources, what can you do? I didn't have the resources at the time, so. I mean, it's nothing to be ashamed of. Nothing at all. You're a new mom, you're a woman, and I'm a single mom at that. So I'm just using resources that they've given, you know what I mean? So,
which don't even cover your whole bill.
It doesn't even cover my whole bill.
Not even half.
Not even half. Not even a quarter, I don't think.
Each state has their own restrictions and rules when it comes to WIC. And some of them don't feel like a health decision. They feel like a budget decision. In Indiana, where I live, you have to buy the least expensive eggs and milk available. You can get organic produce, but you're not allowed to buy organic shelf-stable food or organic baby food. And it can be hard for stores, too. Each grocery store that wants to be a vendor must stock a minimum amount of WIC-approved foods at all times. It can be hard for some local independent stores to meet that requirement, especially international markets. For them, most of the brands and types of food available through WIC are culturally irrelevant for their customers. Here's Rugi again.
You know, being an immigrant, it's a whole new process. It's like being reborn. You have to first unlearn and then learn. When you come here, you've got all kind of information. It took me a while to go through the right channels. I even thought if you take benefits, you will never be documented because they hold it against you. So it takes you a while to just realize that this is just for the child, you know. So I had WIC with my second child.
Rugi is Muslim and likes to shop at halal stores.
They don't take WIC, so it's a problem. I don't know what should be done. Small businesses working with WIC and working with all small business owners so WIC could be accessible to the people. They have to go to a regular grocery stores. And most of the time, when I first started, what I was getting wouldn't even work for me. But I still have just to take it and try it.
You're listening to a story about the single mom's collective, Motherful. In September, President Biden took to the podium to talk food policy.
Welcome to the White House Conference on Hunger, Nutrition, and Health.
Good morning. Thank you very much. It's been over 50 years since President Nixon convened the original White House Conference on Hunger, Nutrition, and Health. That single conference and the laws that inspired it led to transformational change that has helped millions of Americans live healthier lives for generations.
So WIC came out of that first conference and was up and running by 1974. Since then, lots of changes have been made to the program, but the changes have been to which kind of cereal, how many grams of sugar in the juice. Never should we really be dictating the foods pregnant and parenting people can eat. This year, even more program changes are coming, mostly to get people to sign up. You can visit our website to hear an interview with leadership at the USDA for more there. Meanwhile, the collective at Motherful is holding it down for single moms in Central Ohio.
We don't tell you how to vote, but we are an open, progressive nonprofit.
Here's Rugi again.
We support the Black Lives Matter. We support the LGBTQ plus community. We support all immigrants, no matter what their status is. We would support any woman, no matter what her choice is, but we are a pro-choice movement. So we're just an open movement, inclusive, that try to be also wholesome, not only work with moms, but try to take care of all the needs that a single mother's family can have.
The food pantry is just one of the ways Motherful supports single moms. Their core values include reparative justice and health care for all. They host community dinners and bi-weekly Zoom calls with guest speakers. It's more than a place to find food or baby items. It's a politically aware hug around about 325 single moms and their families.
They're not being CEOs. It's mothers like us. We're all together. We are consulted at every level. It's a partnership. I have my own programs here. I get to have inputs and to say, this is what I want to see happen. And they make it happen. I make it happen. They give me the space, the voice. We talk. We decide this is something that is relevant, and we will do it.
Like I said, community is the best resource, I would say. Just community, knowing that others have went through the same thing I've went through, is definitely comforting.
What does that mean for you when you keep saying community? Like, what does that really look like on a day-to-day for you?
If you're feeling down postpartum, you can always ask a friend to, you know, go out. People still check up on me in the community. And not only that, they have an app for Motherful where you can tell your feelings and other women can, you know, reply and give you hope. That's what...
Have you been using that?
I have. I have a lot.
In the middle of the night?
In the middle of the night. Like, I'm feeling a little depressed. So...
Yeah.
But, yeah.
I know about that 3 a.m. thing where you just wake up.
And yeah, that's...
What is this?
No, it's a real thing. It's real. It's real.
He's like, where's my mommy?
Back at the food pantry, I sat down with Heidi Howes. She's co-founder and co-director of Motherful. It's time for her baby to nurse, so we settle into chairs in an upstairs room. Kids are playing, and somebody's vacuuming downstairs. I asked Heidi how WIC relates to Motherful's plan for food justice.
We do have a partner through WIC that we just recently connected with, who is a mom who works there. And so we're looking into it, but, you know, we're just looking for resources that we can just give to moms with no barriers to entry with no requirements, you know. It's like, you need it, here it is. And so that's what we're all about. Personally, I may qualify for WIC right now. I'm not sure. I've had WIC in the past, but I actually didn't like WIC in the past because it was dairy and we don't eat dairy, or I don't eat dairy. But I know now they do have fresh vegetables, and that was something that I think I got on the tail end when my last child was born. But I haven't signed up for WIC now.
I was a teen mom, and I definitely took place with WIC for multiple times because I have three daughters.
Here's Lisa Woodward again. She and Heidi started Motherful together. I asked her how Motherful's resource pantry is different from the WIC program.
How is it different? This is a collective and a community. When I was going through the WIC system, there was not any sisterhood with other of the WIC clients. Our food pantry and garden, it's more free. You can get how much you need, and you can come multiple times. We don't have any like direct nutritional counseling like WIC has, but we do have moms that they share information all the time, just about healthy eating. There's also a lot of different local orgs that deal with nutrition. And so we're connected. So when they have programming, we do post it on our site. But we partner up with WIC for their farmers markets. So we were there. Folks were coming to get food, and then they would also find out about our programming too. And we look forward to tabling with them again as needed. Most of the people that come through WIC are new moms or pregnant moms. So that's really good for us because most of our moms have are not adding to their family. And so it's good that we have those, can help those moms too, that are new moms, that, and you're a single mom. That's like a double, that's a double whammy. So we encourage those connections.
If you could imagine like food for single mothers, someone such as yourself, like in your wildest dreams, like what would you want for someone in your position, but from the government?
I would say like for a period of time, just covering, I would just say like at least half of the expenses. It can be extremely hard. I'm not saying if you're working and if you're able to work, I would say half. But if you're not able to work, I feel like due to you having a child and stuff, I feel like the government should assist mothers, single mothers, especially when they're single. You can't go to work because you just had a baby. I think they should.
Some people call that unpaid labor.
Meaning,
well, when you're taking care of your baby, it is work, right? Like you're working.
Yeah, that's exactly.
You don't get paid.
That's exactly what I was about to say. Not even having the baby, just carrying the baby itself, having to worry about your fat feet and then everything else that comes with pregnancy, that's hard work. That is extremely hard work, having to deal with the insecurities of your body after. That's hard work that you have to do internally. There's so much components to pregnancy, even after pregnancy, that women have to deal with. That's work to me. That's work. So that's labor for me.
You know, the ultimate dream would be like every household has a garden. Like there's a gardening committee that comes to your house and puts the garden in, and it comes every week and helps you weed and teaches you. And then also fresh, healthy food is delivered to mom's houses, period. Preferably cooked. that's actually what we would love to do here at Motherful, is to have prepared foods that we can just give to moms, because it's impossible to do all of these things, you know, as one person in a family. And why not, you know? So bring the fresh, healthy food right to the doors of moms so that they can, you know, take a bath instead of cooking that meal, you know? Because it's really, really hard work being a mom, you know, raising children, and you're sore, your body hurts, you know, just need a minute to rest and decompress, and so you can be in, you know, your full state of love and care to give that to your children, you know, because if moms are good, everybody's good.
Yeah. Just the highest quality of produce and the prepared food thing, that's definitely high on my list, and just someone to help our garden just multiply.
Back in the garage, everybody packs up for the day. Rugi likes to check in at the inn to see about the tomatoes. If there are any left, she takes them home.
Sunday, so I ran out of tomato paste, and today I want to make somebody.
Oh, yeah.
He needs a lot of tomato. I make everything from scratch.
Our ultimate goal as an organization is to build a co-housing village here in Columbus, Ohio, and then to take the model of the Motherful organization and build chapters throughout the world, you know, so that other moms can be empowered to work together for better lives for themselves and their children, and also ultimately to uplift the matriarchy. Yeah. I just see that mothers in power with each other and others, as opposed to power over, which is a patriarchal model. You know, if mothers are in power, like, people are going to be loved. They're going to be fed. They're going to be housed. They're going to be clothed. They're going to be taken care of, you know? And it's just, it's a no-brainer. So if we can get moms out from under the invisibility and out from under the straight-up slavery of reproductive labor and get them into leadership, you know, while they're also being taken care of, you know, and bring children into our common spaces again too, you know, I think that that's going to change the world when moms are running things. It's going to be so much better, and it's just a matter of time.
You seem convinced.
I mean, don't you see it? You know, it has to happen. We can't, I mean, it's that or destruction. Absolute destruction, you know, unless we bring the matriarchal ways back into the forefront. And by that I mean valuing life, valuing the sacred life of all, and love and nurturing and care and interconnectedness and all these things that, you know, colonialism, capitalism, patriarchy, white supremacy, all these things that have been suppressed and killed, and due to those powers, like, when we bring back the matriarchy, when we bring back the matriarchal ways, then we'll be able to save our planet and save ourselves. So it has to happen, or else it's death, you know? Matriarchy is life.
And we're wrapping up another edition of Feminist Magazine. Don't forget, you can find all the links from our program today on our website, feministmagazine.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter, and sharing behind-the-scenes photos on Instagram. Our programs are archived in the kpfk.org audio archives. You can find our podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and via the Stitcher app on your phone, too. Thanks for listening.
Be sure to join me, Ramses Ja, along with Q Ward, Thursday, September 11th for a live edition of The QR Code, starting at 6 a.m. We'll be opening up the phone lines and taking your calls with insightful and engaging conversations on the news of the day, and so much more. You can decide what the conversation will be on The QR Code, Thursday, September 11th at 6 a.m., right here on People Powered, KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles, and online at kpfk.org.
Donating your car or boat is an excellent way to help KPFK stay alive and on air. All you have to do is call 877-KPFK-AUTO. That's 877-KPFK-AUTO, and we'll take care of everything. No, really, it's that simple.
Support
Support for KPFK is brought to you in part by the Marjorie Luke Theater, a 501c3 not-for-profit organization which is hosting the Green Film Series, Conception Media Films, and Engage Stream, presenting a screening of The Cost of Silence on Sunday, September 14th at 4 p.m. at the Marjorie Luke Theater, 721 Cota Street in Santa Barbara. The screening will be followed by a community action forum on the Trump administration's push to open the Santa Barbara Channel to offshore oil drilling, with the film's director, Mark Manning, and the Environmental Defense Center's chief counsel, Linda Kropp.